The Journal from the Radical Reformation grew out of our first Unitarian conference. At that time, we called it a Unitarian conference because we were focusing on that aspect of our theology in that first conference back in Oregon, Illinois, actually. And then we realized that really we needed to have something not at the level of the Restitution Herald, which is for the average church person, but something that was intended to be used in theological schools and to deal with people at that level of education. Well, very, very thankful, of course, for Brother Anthony Buzzard, who brings to us a marvelous skill and ability and academic ability that God has richly blessed our fellowship by bringing him to us. And he really, along with myself and Mark Madison, formed the editorial committee for the, we call it the JRAD, Journal from the Radical Reformation. The reason we do that is because our roots, the roots of the present day Church of God of the Abrahamic Faith, go back really to those days of the Reformation when we think so much about Martin Luther. But in fact, in 1525, just a few years after Luther broke away from the Roman Church, there were a group of people that challenged Luther, holding doctrines that we hold. Someday perhaps I could come here and give a seminar on church history, because it was there that we find people that grew out of the Roman Church as well. Of course, there was only one church back in those days. But these people were imprisoned. These people were given what was called their third baptism. The first baptism having been when they were sprinkled as infants as part of the Roman Church. But later, when they became convinced of the truths of Scripture, they were immersed in a believer's baptism. And their third baptism was when they tied them in sacks and cruelly threw them into rivers to drown them. Well, that was the way the Protestants treated these radicals. The Roman Church preferred burning them at the stake because of what they believed. That's our roots when we talk about truth. How important is the truth? Do we hold it with that same intensity, the intensity that they did? As I was talking about the Journal from the Radical Reformation, we received letters from all over the world. And in fact, it's been very interesting. We've received some from some universities, University of Tübingen in Germany, one of the premier theological schools. They subscribed to our journal because they want it in their library. It's unlike any other journal in the world because there are so few people that are willing to stand up for what the Bible really teaches. In fact, we've had letters from professors from these various institutions say, well, you know, I see what you're saying, and that makes more sense than anything I've ever seen. But sadly, some of them also write and say, but I couldn't possibly teach that. I couldn't possibly teach that because I'd lose my job. Truth. Those people are standing, in my opinion, between their own Bethel and Ai, making a choice, not toward the house of God, not toward what they know is true, but backing away from that, going along with, this looks good over here. Tonight I want to talk about what it takes to sustain us through the hard times. Remember last week, probably you, like myself, were watching the Olympics on television. And when the U.S. women's gymnastic team was vying for the team title, wasn't that exciting? I don't like to really know what happened because it happens earlier in the day. So when I watch the tape delay, for me, it's still happening. And I'm sitting there, probably with you, watching, was it Kelly Strug? Is that her name? First, Dominique falls. How could she fall? And the tenseness grows. We're just a good score from receiving the gold medal. And I'm sitting up at the edge of my seat. We're cheering. And, oh, no! My middle son, Kirk, says, "You know, probably they can't hear you, Dad." Well, maybe not. But it's only downtown Atlanta. Maybe they could. But first, Kelly comes and hits that vault. Comes and falls. We're down to one. We're down to one. And then you see her begin limping as she walks back to the takeoff position. Do any of you have the thoughts that I had at that time? Oh, man, what else can go wrong? Did you watch that little girl? Well, young woman, but she's little. She gritted her teeth and wiggled her ankle and tried to get some feeling in it. She looked over at Bella Caroli, her coach. He said, "You can do it." And she took off. Hit that takeoff board, hit that vault, and planted herself just long enough before she crumpled. But it was long enough. She scored enough points. And the U.S. women's gymnastic team, for the first time ever, received the gold medal in Olympic competition. Man, I felt good for that little girl. Somehow, her strength and her courage and her willingness to face the pain and to do what needed to be done made me feel good. Made me feel good for our country. Made me feel, yes, something in this world is coming out right. But you know, when I turn to the spiritual application to that, the strength to focus. She looked ahead, ignoring the pain, focused on her goal, and she went for it. Turn in your Bibles with me today to Hebrews, the 11th chapter. She saw something, a gold medal for her team, for herself, for her country, and she went for it. In Hebrews, the 11th chapter, that famous faith chapter, that chapter starts out with saying, "Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. That which is invisible, that which we do not see. How certain are you of the kingdom? You can't see it. You can't touch it. You don't know for sure that there will be a kingdom to come. Except you do, don't you? I can't test it. But I know." Turn over later in that chapter to verses 23 through 27. "By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born, because they saw he was no ordinary child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God, rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible." You can't do that. You can't see somebody who is invisible. But you know that that's a pattern in the Bible. Now you know the story of Moses. How he was born, and how the king had decreed that Hebrew male children should be killed, and how his mother hid him in an ark of bulrushes. That's the story you had from the time you were a child in Sunday school. And how God protected him and allowed his own mother to raise him, though Pharaoh's daughter thought and treated him like her own. And he grew up with all of the advantages of this world. Pharaoh's household would have had all the riches and wealth that could be anyone's. All the education, all the authority, all of the advantages of life. But he never forgot who he really was. He had godly parents who helped him to know. And he always remembered that all of this, the treasures of Egypt, were not worth what he was looking for. Notice that. When he had grown up, verse 24, he refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. There's a term called delayed gratification. We're not very good at that in this day and age. Moses understood that, though he probably didn't ever know that term. We want our reward, and we want it now. We want a new car. We go out and we go into debt to buy a new car, because we want it now. Moses could have had all the riches of Egypt, power and authority, a position in the Pharaoh's army. He could have had all of that. But he said, no, I'm not going to do that. Because that's short term. What I really want is going to be delayed. He, of course, had no idea how long, but that didn't concern him. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. Now, of course, Jesus was not born at that time, but the idea of Messiah, of someone who was coming, of a Christ, was already there. And Moses knew about that. He knew that the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob had promised this land. And he didn't know how it was going to work, but he believed in the coming one who would be king. And he had that concept, and he knew that was worth more than what was here in front of him. Verse 27, by faith he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. You remember the story when he came upon someone who was mistreating a Hebrew. He slew him, thinking it was safe. And realizing that he was found out, he figured he had better leave. But it wasn't because he was afraid, but God was leading him. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. Moses was 40 years old. Nothing had happened. Moses was 80 years old, and he still hadn't found what God wanted him to do. But even at 80 years of age, he hadn't lost the picture of what was ahead. He stayed out there in the desert, and it was lonely. The people of God were back there in Egypt, still suffering, but God hadn't shown him yet what he was to do. And it was a lonely time there. But he persevered, because Moses had seen him who is invisible. What does that mean? He'd seen him who is invisible. There are at least three other instances in the Bible of something like this, catching a vision of him who is invisible. Turn with me in your Bible to 2 Kings. 2 Kings, the 6th chapter. Going way back into the history, it was after Moses, of course. We're now in the time of the prophet Elisha. 2 Kings 6, verse 8, now the king of Aram was at war with Israel. After conferring with his officers, he said, I will set up my camp in such and such a place. the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, beware of passing that place because the Arameans are going down there. So the king of Israel checked on the place indicated by the man of God. Time and again, Elisha warned the king so that he was on his guard in such places. This enraged the king of Aram. He summoned his officers and demanded of them, will you not tell me which of us is on the side of the king of Israel? None of us, my lord, the king, said one of his officers. But Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the very words you speak in your bedroom. Go find out where he is, the king ordered, so I can send men and capture him. The report came back, he's in Dothan. Then he sent horses and chariots and a strong force. They went by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army of horses and chariots had surrounded the city. Oh, my lord, what should we do? The servant asked. Don't be afraid, the prophet answered. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And Elisha prayed, O Lord, open his eyes so that he may see. Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes and he looked and he saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. See, Elisha saw that which was invisible. It wasn't God, but it was God's plan and his work. It was God's servants who were there though they couldn't be seen. I love that picture. The servant goes out in the morning and says, all is lost because the king of Aram's armies were surrounding them ready to capture them. Elisha reacts with calmness and said, no, you really haven't caught the picture. Lord, open his eyes. Let him see. Let him see that those who are with us are more than those who are with the king of Aram. And this time when the servant went back, he saw God's plan. There were the chariots of fire protecting God's people. The next instance is found in the book of Isaiah. Turn to Isaiah, the 6th chapter. Isaiah, the 6th chapter, where we have the prophet receiving a vision. 6:1, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphs, each with 6 wings. With 2 wings they covered their faces, with 2 they covered their feet, and with 2 they were flying. And they were calling to one another, holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory. At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. Woe is me, I cried, I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. Then one of the seraphs flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. With it he touched my mouth and said, see, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away, your sin is atoned for. Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? And I said, here am I, send me. That wasn't the usual thing that Isaiah saw. That wasn't the customary thing that when he went into the temple he saw. But on this occasion, God revealed something special to him. He had a personal encounter with the God of the universe. He recognized his unworthiness, but he was made worthy by the God of grace and mercy. So we have Moses who saw him who is invisible. We had Elisha who saw things his servants couldn't see until he prayed to God to open his eyes. We see Isaiah here with a dramatic encounter with the God of Israel. But finally, go with me to the New Testament, to the book of Acts. To Acts, the 9th chapter. Acts 9:1, we have the conversion of Saul, who becomes Paul. Acts 9:1, meanwhile, Saul was still breathing out murderous threats against the Lord's disciples. He went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues in Damascus, so that if he found any there who belonged to the way, whether men or women, he might take them as prisoners to Jerusalem. As he neared Damascus on his journey, suddenly a light from heaven flashed round him. He fell to the ground and heard a voice say to him, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" Who are you, Lord?" Saul asked. "I am Jesus, who you are persecuting," he replied. "Now get up and go into the city, and you'll be told what you must do." The men traveling with Saul stood there speechless. They heard the sound, but did not see anyone. And that's the fourth instance. In this case, it was not the God of the universe, but it was the Son of God now. But we still have an encounter with the eternal, or with his Son. Now, what I want to point out to you, did this change Moses' life? He was no longer willing to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He was no longer willing to take all of the good things of life. He was willing now to be mistreated. He persevered in what God was calling him to, not knowing exactly what it was. But he had seen him who's invisible. Why wasn't Elisha scared like his servant? There were the armies of the king of Aram surrounding him, ready to take him. They no doubt would have killed him. That's what they intended to do. But the God of Israel, opened the eyes of this servant so that Elisha could tell him, "Look, those who are for us are more than they that be with them." And Elisha stood firm in God's calling to him. I wonder about that servant if his life wasn't changed from that moment when he saw what he'd never seen before. And Isaiah, you know, Isaiah was a prince of Israel. But Isaiah had the opportunity to come into the very presence of God and to hear the voice of God, and to be cleansed by a coal from off the altar. He said, "Woe is me, I am unclean." And the angel touched his lips and cleansed him. And he was worthy, not because he was a good man, a fine man, the best man that ever was. No, he was worthy because God cleansed him and called him. "Who will go for me?" said the voice of the Lord. And then Isaiah could say, "Here am I. Send me." And Saul, who was taking Christians like they took the radical reformers, he was taking them and imprisoning them, seeing that they were beaten. You remember what he did when Stephen was being stoned to death. He held the coats so the people could throw their rocks better. Suddenly, this persecutor saw who it was. He was blind, but he saw. He understood. He was blind, but he could see. Those that were with him weren't blind, but they couldn't see. But Saul/Paul saw the Son of God and realized what he had done. "I am the worst of sinners," he said, "for I persecuted the church of God." Was Saul's life changed when he saw the eternal? Go back with me to Hebrews, where we were in the 11th chapter. In Hebrews, the 11th chapter, we read about Moses seeing him who is invisible. Now in the 12th chapter, we have a fifth instance. This is of Jesus himself. Hebrews, the 12th chapter. "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses," the author of Hebrews writes, "let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus,
the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning the shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, who for the joy set before him endured all those things, the beatings, the scorning, the mocking really of his Father. And he persevered because Jesus had seen God's call and understood he was the Son of God. He had a role to play. Jesus, when his disciples said, "You're going to get killed," and he said, "That's why I'm here. That's why I've come to this hour." He understood. He saw something that you and I have never really seen. Not like that. Jesus saw beyond everything that was in front of him, and he saw beyond to the kingdom. We have that time of transfiguration, and it was given to three of his close disciples, Peter, James, and John, to see Jesus in the kingdom. It was a vision, but they saw him in the kingdom. It was given to them to see something that we've never seen. Moses' life was transformed by what he saw. He saw that which is invisible. Elisha had already seen that which most men couldn't see. Isaiah had a vision of the God of heaven. Paul saw it was Jesus who was the Son of God. Jesus himself had seen this. What did they see? It's perhaps described best by Moses, of whom it's recorded he saw that which is invisible. Saw him who is invisible. Folks, you and I need that. Because hard times come on all of us. But nothing any harder has come on us than came on some of those men. Isaiah, for instance, it's thought is the prophet sawn asunder, described at the end of the book, or the Hebrews, the 11th chapter. Jesus, of course, on the cross, being killed for what he'd seen, what he knew, was not right here, but beyond. Moses endured 80 years. And even then, because of a stupid mistake on his part, he missed going into the promised land. But he knew someday. He looked beyond. He looked ahead. He rejected the riches of what this life could offer. For what was ahead? What does it take for us to catch a vision of him who is invisible? You know, it's been my experience that the times when I'm closest to God and have the deepest sense of his will and plan, and am closest to seeing him who is invisible, is when I'm personally going through some of the toughest times of my life. Did you experience that? When everything's going smooth, I don't have that same sense. But when I'm crushed within, when I'm hurt, when I'm severely tested, that's when I begin to see him who's invisible. I don't know if God opens our eyes like he did for the servant of Elisha to help us to see that which will sustain us. Look at Hebrews 12, verse 3. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. In your struggle against sin, you've not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. But sometimes it's felt like that.
I know it has for some of you. There are times in my ministry experience when the church that I was trying to serve didn't value me or appreciate me and rejected me and didn't want me to be their pastor anymore. And it hurt. It deeply hurt. But I grew more through that experience toward God than I did when everything was smooth. You know, we don't like to think about that. We'd rather have everything smooth. We want the riches of Egypt. We want it all to be nice. We want to go toward the lush, well-watered plains. We don't want the dry, arid highlands. We don't want the times of suffering. But it's there, in the dry, arid places, when we feel like we're abandoned, that we find Him who is otherwise invisible to us. In your struggle against sin, you've not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. One of those radicals was named Michael Sattler. Michael Sattler was a man who wrote a confession of faith. A confession of faith that rejected that which was Romish, in favor of that which is more nearly biblical. Now, we wouldn't agree with all that he said, but he was trying to break away from all the false things that the Church of Rome taught. And as he was coming back from having written that credo, the soldiers of the Pope captured him. And he was imprisoned, and he, like John Huss before him, and like Wycliffe before him, said, as they were on trial, "Show us where we're wrong from the Bible, and we will believe." And they were told by those prosecutors, "Be quiet, you heretic. But just show me from the Bible. Shut up." With that kind of language they were treated. And finally, Michael Sattler was condemned to death. They took him from the prison to the place of execution. They forged his hands with chains to the tongue of a wagon. I believe it was six times along the way they stopped and with red hot tongs tore pieces out of his flesh. They finally arrived at the place of execution and tied him to the stake. They put gunpowder in his beard so that it would burn the better and blow up in his face. What did Michael Sattler do? He prayed for his persecutors. So they took those tongs and tried to tear his tongue out of his throat. Why? Because he was trying to stand for truth. Because somehow Michael Sattler saw that in spite of what they were doing to him, to have denounced the faith was only short term. There was the kingdom to come, and it was not worth it. He would endure the pain, and I believe God strengthened him. God was with him in that moment. In fact, it is reported by an eyewitness that as the fires burned through the ropes, Michael Sattler, in a prearranged sign to the other radicals that were watching, put up his hand in a V sign that the pain and suffering was endurable. And he died. The author of Hebrews says, "You have not yet resisted unto blood, but some have." Down through history, some have. Those people, they saw something Him who is invisible, a picture of the kingdom. It was down the way, it was future. But they saw it and they weren't going to give it up. I remember an early minister when I was just a young man saying, "We need more persecution." And in my youthfulness, I said, "Are you nuts?" That was what I was thinking. Because I didn't understand. I didn't want that. I didn't want that. But I've learned that it is through suffering that we come to know the God of Israel and His plan for the future. It's what allows us to persevere. It gives us strength to endure. You see, God is even with us. And in fact, uses times like that to make us what we ought to be. Go back to Hebrews, the 12th chapter. We'll read verse 4 and go on again. In your struggle against sin, you've not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. And you have forgotten that word of encouragement that addresses you as sons, and I might add daughters. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. And do not lose heart when He rebukes you. Because the Lord disciplines those He loves, and He punishes everyone He accepts as a son. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons and daughters. For what son is not disciplined by his father? If you are not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you're illegitimate children and not true sons. Moreover, we have all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits and live? Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best. But God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in His holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. You know, I don't even like to preach this sermon, because the one part of me still resists and says, man, I'd like it all to go smooth. I don't want any health problems. I don't want to have any of my sons create problems for me. I want them to be good Christians. I don't want to have any trouble in my job. I want all to be smooth. In my Kiwanis Club, I want everybody to like me. Well, and I don't know that we should go out of our way to make people not like us. But I also know that troubles, when they come on us, number one, God allows them to be used to strengthen and discipline us. And number two, how we react to those troubles is indicative of the quality of our spiritual life. If you have seen the coming kingdom, oh, you haven't seen it with these eyes, but your mind, you know it's there, don't you? What will that be like when Jesus returns in the clouds of heaven with power and glory? What will that be like for you to watch for? See, is there anything that you can get today that is worth missing out on that? I think that may be why, when Christ returns, the trumpet sounds and the dead in Christ rise first. So they without us are not caught up, but we see the Lord coming. At that moment, if you remain true, there is nothing that will have been worth more than that moment. We see the Lord coming. Our hearts swell within us. We feel our vile bodies change to be like unto His glorious body. I think I'm pointing the right way. How many of those graves will fly open? I'm looking forward to seeing my dad again. And you've all got loved ones. You know. there's nothing, nothing that is worthwhile that doesn't cost. All of those Olympic athletes, they've gone through years of training, discipline, for a momentary reward. Oh, it'll last a few years, and they'll always have that gold medal. Except that, you know, tragically, some of those have appeared in pawn shops. It doesn't even last a lifetime for some. But you know, when death comes, and it comes to all of us, it won't matter if we have a gold medal, silver medal, or bronze. But did you see him who is invisible? Have you remained true to him who is invisible? Has that vision carried you through and you have persevered, even if it comes to the point of blood? I will not forsake him, because he will never forsake me.